This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Baher Azmi, on what we can expect from the Trump administration.
We've got a perfect storm brewing with the collision of the police state apparatus set up under Obama and before him Bush, and the growing movement in the United States for social change.
We'll speak with activist and MOVE member Ramona Africa, along with Professor Johanna Fernandez, about the history of MOVE and a new taping of Inside the Activist Studio.
This is all part of the campaign to bring Mumia Abu-Jamal home. Go to it. It's going to be really, really good.
We're joined by attorney Angela Bibbins, who's on the ground in our weekly dispatch from Standing Rock.
She's a Native American, an attorney, a mother of three, and she's been up there on the legal team for 3 months. Have a listen to what she reports.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The movement for social change in the United States has been growing and accelerating in the last 5 years with the Occupy movement, Black Lives Matter, and now the large encampment and protest of Native Americans and their allies protecting our water in North Dakota. Half of American young people under the age of 29 say they would prefer socialism. Bernie Sanders, running as a Democratic socialist, received more than 13 million votes. It is a time of great possibilities and simultaneously a time of great danger with the election of Donald Trump. What is the state of our democratic rights as we go into the Trump era? Because of the policies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama, Americans are the most spied upon people in the history of the world, with governments surveilling every keystroke on their computers, social media, snail mail, and every email they send. The ancient right of habeas corpus has been compromised, allowing for indefinite detention of American citizens, military commission trials, and imprisonment offshore in Guantanamo, Cuba, and other black sites. Extrajudicial assassinations are regular practice now, with Americans even being targeted and killed by drone strikes. Torture carried out by the CIA and private contractors has gone unpunished. The Posse Comitatus Act has been abolished, and now the U.S. military will be allowed to perform police functions inside the United States. The police force itself has been militarized and given military-grade weapons. What can the movement for social change expect from the Trump administration? We speak today with attorney Baher Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the position that Michael Ratner once held. Azmi is responsible for overseeing litigation and advocacy on discrimination, policing, Guantanamo, Muslim profiling, torture, and militarism. Baher Azmi, congratulations on the CCR's 50th anniversary, and welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
12 years ago in 2004, after the attacks on 9/11 and under the George W. Bush presidency, Michael Ratner wrote the introduction to a collection of Center for Constitutional Rights founding attorney William Kunstler's speeches and articles. The book was called The Emerging Police State. Michael wrote that we are facing the most sustained, deepest assault on liberty that we have ever seen. We would like to ask you, Baher, about the assault with respect to the whittling away of First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendment rights to the Constitution, which we know as our Bill of Rights, and what Trump could do with his executive powers. So initially, Baher, what is the extent of government surveillance now on U.S. citizens?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Michael was observing at that moment was certainly true, and I think one dynamic that the past 15 years has exposed is that it is the sort of old myth civil liberties get suppressed during wartime, but then snap back after the immediate conflict subsides. That mythology has been broken, because I think what we've seen is, or Cold War that we've been in for the past 15 years, there has been a steady systemic weakening of civil rights and expansion of executive power that has been braided with claims of national security and demands for the, you know, executive tools to fight some menace all over the world. And that's manifested in the kind of elimination of basic due process rights in Guantanamo, mass surveillance of U.S. citizens by the National Security Agency, the targeting of Muslim Americans simply on the basis of their religion and national origin, and also the sort of chilling of First Amendment rights around protest, a kind of overexpansion of material support prosecutions to go after activists, Palestinian activists, and others who are engaging what would you would expect normally considered First Amendment protections.
Over the past several months, we've heard rumors that the House Un-American Activities Committee might be revived, and we've heard word of lists of individuals. We know that those who target the government in protests, and we're seeing a resurgence of that, have also been identified. Do you think HUAC will be brought back in some form or another?
I think it's certainly a possibility. I think civil society, hopefully, and the public at large, hopefully, is so mobilized now and so antithetical, so oppositional to the kind of authoritarian instincts of a Trump administration, that unlike the first time, if there is such a committee, people will not go quietly. And I think if it is revived, there will be potential legal challenges and certainly sustained political opposition. But I think that would have to come from the public at large. I am nervous about the kind of weakness of the Democratic leadership to stand up to these kind of authoritarian instincts in the Trump administration and his right-wing supporters in the government, including in the future Attorney General's office. So it would demand kind of mass mobilization of the people to challenge, protest, and ultimately shut down this kind of really ugly inquisition.
Progressive attorneys have been increasingly relying on Freedom of Information Act requests to access information that has really been held from the public over the last couple of decades. Can you comment on the center's lawsuit under FOIA regarding Black Lives Matter and discuss how hard it is to get compliance with these requests?
I think you're quite right, Heidi, that Freedom of Information Act as a social justice tool has really increased in the past 15 to 20 years. My sense is before 9/11 in the 80s and 90s, Freedom of Information Act was an important tool for journalists, for environmental activists, for historians to understand, you know, sort of get transparency about past government practices. And since 9/11, in a large part through a number of important kind of FOIA lawsuits trying to obtain evidence from the government regarding torture and secretive practices filed by CCR and the ACLU and others, it is now a really critical tool in a social justice lawyer's and an activist's arsenal. So we've paired with a terrific grassroots black-led organization called Color of Change and filed a Freedom of Information Act litigation against the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI trying to ascertain to what extent they are targeting Black Lives Matter and other activists in a series of protests that occurred in response to police violence all over the country. And is almost always the case, our requests were met with no information, sort of no disclosures from the agencies, and also a claim that they're entitled to keep this information secretive. So we had to take the agencies to court, and we'll argue there that there is the government has to disclose the extent of their surveillance with whatever appropriate redactions, but that it's critical for our democratic institutions to know how law enforcement is trying to infiltrate surveil and control democratic activism in this country.
On another topic that we're all interested in learning more about, that's torture. What do you think the effect has been of the Obama administration's refusal to prosecute illegal torturers?
This is a great disappointment for us regarding the Obama administration. In addition to its failure to close Guantanamo, its failure to robustly investigate in a meaningful way and then ultimately prosecute what are violations of U.S. law. Torture is a war crime that Congress has saw fit to punish like any other crime. And the Obama administration made an intentional political decision not to even meaningfully investigate the role of CIA and high-level government officials for war crimes. And so I think to some extent that has normalized or legitimated the conversation about torture and placed it in the context where it's simply a policy decision, you know, where Republicans like torture and Democrats don't. When the truth is, it's not a policy decision, it's a legal question, and it is systematically and consistently illegal. And the failure to classify it as illegal has permitted, I think, the public to accept that this is just a right-left question of policy, and that's a disaster.
Yeah, I think also because of the fear generated after 9/11, the public went along with it, and it really is not opposed to it. It's my own opinion, but it's so troubling to see that they did not prosecute these people.
I think that's right, but I think as you see, a paradox is that the support for torture went down, you know, in the mid-2000s, in large part because of the advocacy of John McCain and the sort of ugliness by which the people started to perceive the Bush administration. It started creeping up after 2009, and the dynamics are interesting. Among Democrats, support for torture is consistently low, but it started creeping up fairly significantly among Republicans, and this goes to my point. That people see it as a policy issue. It started going up 2009. What happened in 2009? Barack Hussein Obama was elected president, and Republicans now treat torture kind of in the way people think about the death penalty. No one really pays that much attention to it, but they see it as a proxy, just as the death penalty is a proxy for being tough on crime. Now people see torture as a proxy for being tough on terrorism, rather than, again, just a policy decision rather than an utterly illegal act.
Let's talk about habeas corpus, the ancient right. Where does habeas corpus stand right now? Can American citizens be indefinitely detained and can be tried before military commissions? What's happened to that structure that was set up?
We may have to be prepared for this possibility. If an American citizen engages in what the government believes is an act of terrorism, it may be under this administration that person is not arrested by the FBI and placed into criminal proceedings and given a lawyer. It may be that this person is apprehended, seized by the military, the Department of Defense, placed in a military brig, not given counsel, either detained as an enemy combatant or tried in a military commission. I think that the question of whether or not that is legal was actually never conclusively resolved in the Bush administration. There were cases in which U.S. citizens were charged as enemy combatants, but the Bush administration skillfully avoided the sort of ultimate judgment of the U.S. Supreme Court. So the question is somewhat open. Certainly our position at CCR is, and you know, this is based on centuries-long legal precedent in the United States, that U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, and indeed anyone on U.S. soil who commits a crime, and terrorism and its entailments are crimes, is entitled to the protections of the Constitution and cannot simply be subject to martial law because the president deems them a threat. That would be a really sort of crossing a legal Rubicon that would be very, very scary in our country.
Bahar, we've heard a lot about the Espionage Act in the last few years. Can you briefly describe what that is and how it applies to Edward Snowden?
So the Espionage Act is this really pretty odious... I mean, one thing we have to thank the Espionage Act for is it birthed our modern First Amendment law. The Espionage Act was passed by Congress under the Woodrow Wilson administration avowedly to punish dissenters from World War I, of which there were many in that era. And so there were hundreds of prosecutions on the Espionage Act for people who advocated against the war at the time in the terms of the act, interfered with the American prosecution of the war. That's not the exact statutory language. You know, ultimately, there were a number of prosecutions at the time, and the Supreme Court upheld those prosecutions until Justices Oliver Wendell Holmes and Brandeis started recognizing that these prosecutions made no sense and that people should be able to oppose their government on these major questions. And ultimately, those two intellectualized and founded our modern First Amendment doctrine. It says the government cannot punish you for protected First Amendment activity, even if the government believes it constitutes interference with the prosecution of the government's wartime powers. So I think that the principle of to apply it here would be to revive this really ugly statute, and it has been applied to they're proposing to apply it to Edward Snowden insofar as he leaked government secrets in the public interest, and whistleblowers should not be subject to the Espionage Act, particularly ones that act so obviously in the public interest and in trying to stop unlawful U.S. conduct.
Yeah, it's worth noting that the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other presidency in the history of the United States. But I wanted to ask you about the National Defense Authorization Act, Bahir. Section 1021 says that the U.S. Army can now be used domestically for police matters. Why is this dangerous?
Well, it's dangerous because, we're supposed to have a separation of a civilian and military authority in this country, and the military is presumptively only supposed to operate abroad during bona fide, conflicts, while civilian authorities are supposed to manage domestic actions. So what that provision ultimately does, it circles back to the kind of open question of whether or not it is lawful for the United States to detain a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident under the military authority that I mentioned before. So it's worrying, but in truth, it would not authorize anything more than the Constitution would authorize. In other words, it could not authorize the detention of a U.S. citizen as an enemy combatant if the courts interpret the Constitution correctly and say that's a step too far.
Michael Ratner wrote about demonizing people, about the government fabricating enemies and terrifying, really, the citizenry. And we hear about the dangers of radical Islamic terrorists from Trump. But as we all know, Americans are more likely to be killed by a toddler with a gun or struck by lightning or even stung by a bee. In our last few minutes, can you let us know your thoughts about the use of fear to enable the government to put in place a police state and the measures we've been talking about, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, I think fear is one of the greatest political weapons one can marshal, because it surfaces in us, all sorts of primal emotions. And fear connected with concern about the other is equal parts effective and dangerous, and we should expect our politicians, responsible politicians, and I think Obama has been largely a responsible adult, at least in terms of his rhetoric on this, not to take the sort of public's instincts to those dark levels. But when we have a demagogue who is seeking power, that's a potion he can't resist. And I think that is enormously dangerous, because it will undergird, you know, not just his election, but support for dangerous policies like registration and surveillance that have nothing to do with genuine threats. And I think as a public, we have to stand up for immigrants and Muslims and, you know, Black and Latino protesters and demand recognition as fully equal citizens. At the same time, support their own organizing and demands for legitimacy in our democracy.
Well said, Bahir. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and congratulations. It's the 50th anniversary of the Center for Constitutional Rights, great organization, and its legal department is headed up by truly a very fine attorney, and it's been great to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, Michael and Heidi. Thank you very much.
Michael, one of our favorite guests, former Colonel Anne Wright and now peace activist extraordinaire, is going to be speaking at the Musty Institute on Tuesday, December 6th. She's speaking at 7 on the women's boat to Gaza, which we talked to her about here on the show, and also on Standing Rock's Water Protectors movement. So it's open to the public. I hope you and others will come.
Absolutely. Anne Wright is really... it sounds trite to say it, but she truly is a national treasure.
Yeah, the event is at 7. It's at 168 Canal Street, 6th floor. And if people have any questions, they can email me at heidi@ajmustee.org.
Thank you. This week, as part of our ongoing coverage of the Dakota Area Pipeline situation, we are very pleased to be joined by Attorney Angela Bibbins. Attorney Bibbins is a Santee Dakota Indian. She's an attorney from Denver, Colorado, where she practices criminal law, family law, and she has a specialty in the Indian Child Welfare Act. Angela has been on the ground for 3 months coordinating the Water Protector Legal Collective at the Ositi Sakawan Camp near the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe.
Angela Bibbins, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what brought you to Standing Rock?
To be honest, my relatives invited me up here. I was not an NLG attorney until this experience, and I'm Santee Dakota by heritage. My dad was an enrolled member of the Santee Sioux Nation in Northeast Nebraska, and law students who study federal Indian law meet up every year at the Federal Indian Bar Conference. And when I was in school in 2003, graduated in 2006, that conference was in New Mexico in Albuquerque. And I met other law students from the Osheti Shakawi Seven Council Fires and have maintained contact and friendships with all of them. All of them were conflicted out to be able to be on the ground here. And I had the time and certainly the motivation to come here and protect my relatives, knowing that there had already been arrests and I have criminal law experience as a public defender in Colorado.
In the 3 months that you've been on site, how have things changed and what's the current situation?
I think the most alarming thing that has changed is the escalation of violence perpetrated by the Morton County Sheriff's Department on the water protectors. Most evidenced by the use of the water cannons, the concussion grenades, and the rubber bullets that were deployed on water protectors in sub-freezing temperatures on Sunday evening, where there were over 300 injuries that occurred.
That went on for 6 hours, I understand. This was,
it sure did.
It seems to... us here at a distance, that was just deliberate sadistic cruelty.
We agree.
What are you and the other lawyers on the team doing about this and generally your practice up there?
So the Water Protector Legal Collective today intends to file a temporary restraining order in federal court against the Morton County Sheriff's Department to restrain them from the use of potentially lethal force at water protection activities.
They're putting out a story that it was actually the water protectors that provoked this and that the police were acting in self-defense. In a nutshell, can you tell us exactly what happened?
I can tell you what our legal observers reported back to me at the scene. They said that water protectors went up to clear the burnout cars from the October 27th flashpoint confrontation, and it's been 3 months since anybody's been able to use this public highway. It prevents the residents of Standing Rock from having access to timely emergency medical services, access to other services that can only be had in Bismarck and Mandan. And I think that there was just a frustration on the part of the camp that this is a public roadway and that this is a civil right that we have to use the public roadways for the benefit of the public good. And so I think that was the motivation. And how the Morton County Sheriff's Department responded was a complete disregard for the value of human life, deploying water cannons when the temperature here was 22 degrees. They caused a hypothermic reaction in about 200 people, over 200 people, and several other injuries, including an elder who became unconscious at the scene, was fortunately revived by medics, and another young person who had an epileptic seizure. People were maced to the point where they lost bodily function, vomiting and such.
What could President Obama do about this? The project's been stalled now. The company has asserted that they're going to complete it, and recently one of the banks in Norway has pulled out. There's a lot of money here at stake. There are some big loans that the banks have made to the project. Do you think there's any chance that it could be stopped, and what could be done to stop it? What could Obama do? What's your thinking on that?
Well, right now the pipeline, Dakota Access has made it all the way to the drill pad that is west of the shore of the Missouri River. And the tribe has continued to have meetings with Colonel Henderson from the Omaha Army Corps of Engineer office. He has given assurance to the tribe that if Dakota Access does attempt to start drilling without the permit that's required to drill under the river, that they would call in the federal marshals, presumably to interfere with that kind of construction activity. I think that here in the camp, people are pretty frustrated and distrustful that what the Army Corps says will happen will actually happen. And certainly the Obama administration has been called on to intervene, and they've only to this point asked Dakota Access to sort of voluntarily refrain from further construction. And even after that, they continue to build up to the drill pad.
What are the plans of the water protectors now that winter has set in?
People are preparing for winter all around camp. Construction projects continue. Here in the legal tent, last week we had to dump all the contents of the Army tent out into the reception area so that a wooden floor could be installed with hay underneath as insulation. We have wood stove inside. That's what's going on across the camp. More structures are being built that are better suited for winter climates like Mongolian yurts. There are several dome structures now visible. I'm standing on the top of Facebook Hill looking out over Ocheti Shakowi camp and can see some of these projects that are in progress.
How many people are there now, and does that population increase over the weekends? Where are people coming from? What sort of people? Can you give us an idea of the support you're getting?
Sure. We are seeing a great outpouring of support from allies across the country, actually North America. And every day I go to the community meeting in the Big White Dome, and That's where newcomers are welcome to start their day and then go to orientation sessions so that they get some framework for what is going on here, the land that they're standing on, the 1851 and 1868 treaty land that was never ceded by the Hunkpapa, the Great Sioux Nation. And so what is my hope that they are humbling themselves to the indigenous leadership here so that they are doing this work in the peaceful, prayerful way that has been set out by the elders. And at least 50 to 100 new people arrive at just at the community meeting. That doesn't begin to capture how many new people might actually be in camp. I've been here since August, so I've seen the camp swell and shrink, and it's swelling again. So I would estimate at least 5,000 people, most likely, you know, more like 6,000 or 7,000.
It's just an extraordinary, historic thing here. What would you suggest our listeners do to support the water protectors?
If they cannot come to Standing Rock to stand with the Tatishakawi, I would suggest that they send supplies. We are always in need of wood. Shipments of wood come in. We're in need of food supplies, medical supplies. There's a call out for that right now with all of the treatment that medics administered. They're running low on supplies. You can look at what's going on oshetishakawicamp.org to get more information. And that's spelled OCETISAKOWIN camp.org.
Excellent. Heidi and I would like to thank you very much. And we'll keep checking in with you. And, you know, good luck to your work. Thank you.
Pidamaya, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The New York-based activist group, the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home, is filming the second episode of an innovative project. Inside the Activist Studio will be filmed on December 6 at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. Inspired by the popular television series Inside the Actor's Studio, its inaugural show featured a profile of political prisoner Sekou Odinga. The second episode features an interview with longtime activist Ramona Africa of the MOVE organization. Ramona was the only adult survivor of the police bombing of the MOVE home in West Philadelphia on May 13, 1985. The bombing caused a fire that the city's fire department initially allowed to burn and that killed 11 MOVE members, including 5 children. It devastated the 6200 block of Osage Avenue, destroying 61 homes and damaging many others. Joining us today to talk about Inside the Activist Studio and the 31st anniversary of the MOVE bombing are Professor Johanna Fernandez and Ramona Africa. Welcome, Johanna and Ramona, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. Wonderful to be here.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you for having us.
Johanna, how did you come up with the idea for the series Inside the Activist Studio?
Well, Inside the Activist Studio is one of the projects of the campaign to bring Mumia home. And the campaign emerged a number of years ago with the objective of linking emerging younger activists with the veteran, experienced activists who over the last 33 or so years have been active in the movement to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. And as we developed a structure for the campaign, we thought that we needed some kind of routine that would help us bring in a younger generation of activists. And part of what we discussed in these meetings was that we want to be able to build a culture of resistance in the United States. And we also wanted to somehow bring in the legacy of Mumia's radical journalism into our work. We envisioned a project and our work in a way that would really reflect Mumia's analysis of capitalism, imperialism, racism, and war. And a number of us had just watched an episode of Inside the Actor Studio, which is the popular show on mainstream television that interviews actors. It's essentially a biography of actors and how they became who they are today. And we thought this is exactly what we need to do for activists. And our objective is to explore the biography of radicalization among activists of a different generation to essentially pass on to new generation of activists the lessons of struggle. And we also want to educate the public about a wide range of social movements, and we want to inspire people to become lifelong activists like Ramona Africa.
Ramona, when I think of radicalism, you're one of my favorite role models for a radical activist. Can you tell our audience what radicalized you?
Well, I can start off by saying I am the least likely suspect to end up being a revolutionary, a radical. What radicalized me, revolutionized me, is John Africa and John Africa's Move organization. I was deeply entrenched in the system. I was raised in a middle-class black family. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. I ended up in Temple University with a pre-law curriculum. I was headed to law school, and my mother was in my ear telling me, you know, you can be what you want to be a doctor, be a lawyer, you know. And that's where I was headed. That was my foundation. In my last semester at Temple University, I entered into a work-study program and got hired as a paralegal with Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. And I ended up at a meeting to plan a Move demonstration. And I met my sister Pam Africa, who was a supporter at that time. And she talked to me a lot about Move because she lived right down the street. She was a committed Move supporter. She encouraged me to go over to City Hall and sit in and listen to what was going on at the Move hearings of that time. And when I did that, I was shocked and shaken at how the court was operating. Nothing like what those textbooks I was reading or those professors that I had at Temple was telling me is the way the legal system operates. I didn't see any of that. And it kept me coming back. I ended up going up to the prison to visit Move people, and that became regular, like once a week. And I became identified as a Move supporter and became targeted, you know, for harassment. And it was actually Judge Lynn Abraham, who was not a district attorney at the time, she was a judge, who presided over a case that I had then, and she gave me 2 months contempt for speaking out after she asked me if I had anything to say before sentencing. And she gave me 2 months contempt in the county jail, which put me up close and personal with committed Move women for 2 months. When I walked out of there after those 2 months, that was it. I wanted to be in Move, like Move people. I did not want to go to law school, you know. That's how it went.
And Ramona, when you reference the Move hearings, are you talking about community members, some of them complaining about the Move family? Is that what those early hearings were about?
No, actually, this was in like March or so of 1979. So it was after August 8th, and Move people were already in prison for the alleged murder of Officer James Ramp.
Right.
These were pre-trial hearings at particular incidents.
That was after a siege on the Move House, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I saw Move people representing themselves, clearly exposing the contradictions and lies of the prosecution witnesses. And I was just impressed with Move people. And at the same time, I was shocked and appalled at the judge, the prosecuting attorneys. I mean, their conduct was just appalling, you know? They just drew me right into Move.
Let's talk about Move. Johanna, are your students, you teach history here in New York City, are your students aware of Move?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, the fight between Move and the authorities in Philadelphia is one of the least explored and least studied events in 20th century American history. So my students actually know nothing about Move.
Which is extraordinary, because it was just this unbelievable thing that happened there. Maybe we should share with our audience in a nutshell what happened in Philadelphia.
Right. So what we have in the example of Move is that we see that the government unleashed one of the most violent campaigns of repression against a black organization in the early 1970s into the 1980s. In 1978, the Move House, the Move compound, was attacked by the Philadelphia Police Department. And it was
under the administration of Frank Rizzo, which should ring a bell with a lot of people.
It certainly does with me.
Absolutely. Essentially, a cop who was eventually elected to mayor in that city, whose campaign of law and order was replicated throughout the nation and essentially taken on by the likes of Nixon and Reagan. In any case, in 1978, there's the siege of the Move House when tons of gallons of water are literally dumped into the Move House with fire hoses. Out of that attack on the Move House, 9 Move members are arrested and accused of one police officer, Officer James Ramp, who many journalists and investigators say were killed by police-friendly fire. And then we know Move because the government in Philadelphia continued its campaign of violent repression, and in 1985, it dropped the government, the police, with the assistance of the fire department, dropped a military-grade bomb on the Move House, which killed 11 men, women, and children, and burnt down 61 homes in one of the most vibrant African-American communities in Philadelphia. Again, a pretty dramatic deployment of violence against civilians, ordinary people in that city. And the reason why we're interviewing Ramona Africa is because she is the sole adult survivor of the Move bombing of May 1985.
One thing I would like to add to, Johanna talked about the tons of water that was poured in on us in 1985. It was the same in 1978, but what people need to understand is that this was done by the fire department. I mean, firefighters take an oath to save lives, but when it came to Move, they worked hand in hand with the police, really, to get down to the nitty-gritty to kill off Move, you know? And the other thing that needs to be clear is what was Move accused of in 78 when the cops came out there? What were we accused of in 85 when the cops came out there? I mean, we weren't accused of murder, rape, robbery, drug pushing, molesting children, or anything like that. In 78, it was a civil action. They wanted us to vacate our home, and we wouldn't. In 85, they issued warrants against four of us, stating disorderly conduct, and they added terroristic threats, which was ridiculous. But these were the charges that they came out there with. And it's very clear that these charges were just trumped-up charges to try to justify their attempt to exterminate MOVE.
And Ramona, it's worth noting that there were hearings held by officials in Philadelphia, but no one was held accountable, correct?
Absolutely. Not one single official was ever charged with anything, prosecuted for anything, or sent to jail for anything. The only person to go to jail as a result of what they did May 13th of 85 was me, for a riot, no less. I'm in my home with my family when we're surrounded by cops, firefighters, all determined to kill us off, initiating an attack against us at our home, but I rioted. They accused me of rioting.
Ramona, what words of encouragement do you have for people, especially young people, just awakening to social justice activism?
Well, the main thing I would like to put in people, make people aware of, giving them something to think about, is one of the first things that John Africa taught MOVE, and that is that just because something is legal doesn't make it right. Slavery was legal, the Holocaust was legal, apartheid was legal, but none of these things were right. So don't ever let anybody tell you that you don't have the right to protest something, you know, to take issue with something just because they tell you it's legal. Stand up for what's right, legal or no.
I think it's important to ask the question, why was MOVE considered such a big threat in Philadelphia in the 1970s? And I think that giving your audience a sense of what MOVE stood for is very important. MOVE is one of the most important organizations of the early 1970s, in part because it envisioned a new society in the ashes of the old. And it worked with people in Philadelphia to transform their lives and their outlook and critique of the rotten system in which we live. Essentially, MOVE is a revolutionary urban organization that's rooted in healthy, cooperative living. It's an organization that is very environmentally conscious and understands that we live in a system that destroys life and destroys the environment. It's an organization that stands against racism.
Anti-materialism.
Anti-materialism. And in many ways, it really created a cooperative unit and family that many young people are envisioning and in the middle of trying to create today. So it was really ahead of its time.
And a threat, therefore, to the status quo.
Absolutely.
I'd like to point out as well that everything basically that MOVE was criticized for, ostracized for when we first emerged in Philadelphia is very, very acceptable today. Let's start with our hair. When MOVE stopped combing our hair and let it lock, people, black, white, and whatever, were hollering out, "Comb your hair! Take a bath," you know. Raw food. John Africa encouraged MOVE to eat raw food. And in doing that, people said, "Oh, you're going to make yourself sick. You're going to make your children sick. You got to cook your food. You can't eat it like that." Now there are raw food restaurants all across this country. raw food is encouraged by nutritionists, etc. And when I spoke about the hair, let me go back and say, look at your athletes. You see locks hanging out under those football helmets today. You see actors and actresses and all type of celebrities wearing their hair in locks today. We were told that we had to send our children to this system school, that, you know, to homeschool them, they would not be able to, you know, take care of themselves when they got older, and we were depriving them and all of that. But today, homeschooling is very popular. It's done all over the place, you know. Natural childbirth. People said, oh, you got to go to the hospital. You're going to kill your baby. You can die. And today, natural childbirth, as much as the system can do it, it's not exactly like, because we had our babies naturally at home. In fact, one of our Move 9 sisters, Debbie Africa, gave birth to her son in September of 78 after that police attack, naturally in a jail cell, you know, had her baby naturally like she would have had at home. So I'm just pointing out these things. Oh, composting. People said we were dirty and nasty because we took up the concrete and turned the dirt over and, you know, fertilized it with eggshells and seeds and potato peelings, etc. Now, they put a cute little word on it called composting, and it's the thing to do today. It's the green thing to do. But all of these things take you away from this system that makes an industry out of everything from birth to so-called death. You know, they make an industry out of it to make money.
Ramona, we wanted to announce the event on December 6th. It will be the day after this program is airing in New York. And at 6 p.m., doors are going to open at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, which is at 515 Malcolm X Boulevard, for the live taping of Inside the Activist Studio. And I understand, Johanna, it's first come, first serve, and it will last about 2 hours.
Yes, absolutely. So it is open and free to the public. We ask people to come join us for this live recording of this very important interview, during which we are going to explore these questions raised today. What was MOVE? Why did it become a target? How did it suffer? And why violent repression at the hands of the government? So we are going to discuss all of these issues. We're going to ask Ramona a series of questions. The host for the evening will be Dr. Robin Spencer, who's a professor of history at Lehman College. We're very excited about this evening's event, and we encourage everyone to join us on Tuesday, December 6th at the historic Schomburg Center. Doors open at 6.
Ramona, in our couple of minutes remaining, can you give us a quick update on the state of Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal's health and the lawsuit?
He is still itching very badly all over his body because they are not treating the root of his problems, which is the hepatitis C. As you know, last December, documents were filed to force the DOC, the Department of Corrections here in Pennsylvania, to give Mumia the cure, not treatment, the cure. There is a cure for hepatitis C, but it costs $1,000 a pill, which you have to take every day for 3 months for 90 days. So you're talking about $90,000. That's one reason the Department of Corrections is really balking and screaming about giving Mumia this cure, because they know if they do that, they're going to have to give it to all of the, I think, close to 10,000 inmates here in Pennsylvania that have hepatitis C. So anyway, he's not getting the cure. his health goes up and down a little bit. Sometimes the itching goes away and he has a bit of a respite from, you know, those symptoms. But then it comes back. Then it comes back. And what they're giving him, Otezolin, I think it's called, you see advertisements on TV, and it tells you all the side effects. Diarrhea, which Mumia has had for several months now, you know, and that's not a lightweight thing. Short-term memory, you know, loss, having trouble remembering things. I mean, there's all kinds of side effects from this drug that they're giving him for the itching, you know, rather than giving him the cure. So, you know, he's not doing good. He can't be doing good as long as this disease is allowed to fester in him when they can give him the cure. His liver, you know, it has to be damaged. Has to be damaged. They're saying just a small portion of it is like starting to get a little hard, but we know it's worse than that. So the push to get Mumia the cure, which will help, you know, thousands of other inmates, it's serious. I mean, these people took responsibility for Mumia and every inmate that is imprisoned, really, across this country. They took responsibility for them when they took custody of them. So they have to be made to live up to that responsibility. You can't see somebody sick like this and ultimately can die from it and just sit back and do nothing, saying, no, well, we can't help them. This cure is too expensive. They don't have the right to do that.
Ramona, we have few minutes left, but I just wanted to let the audience know that we will be traveling from New York City to Philadelphia on December 9th, which is the anniversary of Mumia's imprisonment on December 9th, 1981. And if people want information about that, they can call 347-709-2264. Once again, that's 347-709-2264. We will be traveling to Philadelphia to demand that Mumia be treated with hepatitis C cure on Friday, December 9th.
This wasn't enough time, so we're urging people to go to this incredible taping on December 6th, and we'd love to have you back on, Ramona, in the next few months.
Problem.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
All right,
thank
now,
you.
On a move, and long live revolution.
On a move, take
on
care.
On a move.
Okay.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.